All right. Thank you, Meta Nomad, for coming on the Foxed In here.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, I love to interview different Twitter or internet thinkers, essentially. And what a lot of listeners may not know is I was a voracious reader of philosophy, and I loved that in college. I just went into more of a psychology realm because I thought, well, it's a little safer to do that and be able to get money from sessions and insurance. And that's its own beast, though. You're kind of like selling out and hoping to influence the machine a little bit by going into it and putting some good ideas in versus standing up and actually just writing from a pure philosophy perspective. So we're going to get some really good ideas. So one thing I want listeners to hear is the origins of your name, Meta Nomad. If you'd unpack that a little bit for us.
Okay. I actually know this. It's the second post on the blog.
Right.
Meta-nomad.net.
Yeah.
And what it was that at the time I was reading a lot of blogs which had basically stifled themselves. And I was coming to a lot of blogs late, and a lot of them had clearly, based upon their name or their theme, had reached the limit of what they could within that which they'd named themselves. So the nomad is the nomadic idea from Deleuze, which is kind of the nomad who moves from node to node or point to point and never truly sticks to a certain ideology or a certain idea, but goes to them briefly and takes something from it and moves along. And then Meta was basically just to open that up and say, basically to say, look, this blog could become anything. And it has over the years. You know, it's had brief forays in kind of the work, different philosophers and different ideas. And, you know, at the moment it's sort of taking a strange, sincere turn towards comfy stuff. Yeah, but that's the origin. That's the origin.
Beautiful. Well, you said a few years now. So how long have you been writing it? It's been a few.
I think it's 2016. I think.
Nice.
So
okay.
3 years.
Yeah. Almost four at this point.
Oh yeah.
I know, right? It's weird to think about.
I try not to think too much about sounds really pretentious already, but I try not to think about time too much in that manner because it's the whole time is relative and time is subjective thing. It's like, I'll try, stick to that, you know? So it's like, oh, it's 4 years ago, but it's like, well, actually at the time, like the last 4 years has gone really, really slowly for me in a good way. So
that's good.
I'm just going to stick to that.
Exactly. It is very subjective. So the hermeneutics question is amazing. Okay. So I'll have it in the podcast description, but just for anybody listening who doesn't know, which, come on, Meta Nomad does the Hermeneutics podcast, which has great graphic design, the bright yellow and the circular, the arcane figures in the central circle. It's a very eye-catching, and the guests are an eclectic assortment of thinkers, including magicians, philosophers who might rightly be called intellectual magicians. It's spectacular. And I want to throw out there how I heard about it. Have you seen Grit Cult's account on Twitter?
Yeah, I know. I think I've probably spoken to Grit Cult a couple of times. But yeah.
Okay, right. So somebody asked him for recommendations on podcasts. And he's like, Hermeneutics is great. And I look at it and I'm like, well, it is great. Because I've never seen a podcast where Nick Land is interviewed or a few of the other ones, because I had heard of John Michael Greer, who is a postmodern druid, essentially, very, very sincere about the beliefs. That podcast went specifically the Magic One Occult 101 just flew by when I was listening to that, and I encourage anyone to listen to it because it's not what you expect. It's going to be about the emotional underpinnings of magic rather than anything corny. It was very, very sincere. Very fascinating. So, which brings me to something that Hermeneutics is responsible for. I have to say, the question that you ask of who would you put in a room, alive or dead, three people, is absolutely spectacular. I've asked my guests that. That's kind of something I use. And full credit to Hermetics for that. Where did you get that idea?
Where did I get that? Yeah. I think it was, you know, it's nowhere special. It was something that I think we used to get asked in school when I was younger. It's like, if you could meet anyone from the past. And then I realized actually I can kind of tweak that. And my thought on it was that basically the guest at that point of time, it's going to reveal to a certain degree their interests. And of course, if they've had prolonged interests, it's going to reveal the connections between whoever they pick. It's going to reveal a sort of theme, and you can sort of play off that. It hasn't always worked.
Fine. Damn.
It hasn't always worked that well, but yeah.
Right. Right. It hasn't always worked that well when you've asked people.
Well, sometimes, you know, they just say who they'd like to meet and why, and there's not too much you can really pick from it. But it's interesting all the same.
Yeah, it is. Man, it'd be great to think of the most dissonant figures to put in a room, but they probably wouldn't stay in the room very long unless it's just like some purgatorial prison where they have to come to some sort of agreement, like that Twilight Zone episode where you find out all the people are sitting there talking and they're toys the whole time. Have you seen that one?
No, I haven't seen
it. It's like dystopian Toy Story. That would be a fun experiment. So if you wouldn't mind, who can you tell us the three that you would have? Because that's what I really want to know. I bet you've got a great trifecta.
I had a fairly clear trifecta until recently.
Okay.
Which was Friedrich Nietzsche, Immanuel Kant, and Hermes Trismegistus. But I've since removed... Basically, Nietzsche will always be there. I always will want to meet him. And I don't think I really... There's no real reason why I need to explain that. I think for anyone who's studied philosophy, Nietzsche always stands out as someone who, you know...
Of course.
So yeah, like it goes beyond explanation.
Yeah.
So at the moment, I think with my current interests, one's going to be Nietzsche. So that leaves me with two. I think Emil Cioran, who was a Romanian and then later French philosopher who wrote On the Heights of Despair and The Trouble with Being Born, and some of the bleakest books you'll ever read. But at the same time, who's just a generally I don't think I've ever come across a philosopher who writes so bleakly yet has such a sincere undercurrent of overcoming. And I think I'd like to discuss with him how he overcame that. And then the third person, actually, now I come to think of it, would be Ernst Jünger. Just in terms of, I think, any discussion with Jünger, you'd leave the room and you would be extremely motivated and disciplined.
Mm.
Yeah,
spectacular. So two of those figures were in your top books of 2019, in fact, right?
Yeah, Jünger and Cioran, yeah.
A Short History of Decay. I was looking, I've got that in my list. I want to have some time to read that. It seems like a book ahead of its time, to say the very least.
Yeah, I mean, Cioran's a strange character because he's one of those philosophers who never really took off, and it's clear why, because one, he's extremely bleak to the point where I don't really think there's many books I've read which are bleaker. There's maybe two, but in terms of his entire corpus, like, you know, that it's up there in terms of real, you know, I can't articulate it because he's sure probably the greatest aphorist who ever lived. Mm. But also it's not entirely philosophy. It's less philosophical than Nietzsche and in many places more poetic than Nietzsche.
Right.
And he I think he did consider himself a Nietzschean, and he's been titled the last Nietzschean. So I think, you know, to say he's a philosopher, I don't really know if that's a good way to put it. But give yourself time with the books, you know. I kind of have one every 6 months because otherwise it all gets a bit tainted. But it's good to have a kind of black reminder, I think.
Yeah, a memento mori. What are the two bleakest books that you've read besides the Tiara?
The Conspiracy Against the Human Race by Thomas Ligotti.
Okay.
And then the first one is the Thirst for Annihilation by Nick Land, Georges Bataille and Virulent Nihilism. There is oddly strange hints of an inhuman hope in that book, but your first read will be some real bleak going. And I think it's a real, anyone who can decipher it and understand it, it's a real test of whether or not you can break through the first barrier of, do I want to keep going?
Right. Yeah. Barrier to entry there. So how young did you realize you wanted to study philosophy? You wanted to go into that?
Blimey. I think I was 21.
Mm.
It's fairly late. I studied art as my bachelor's, fine art, and then realized in my second year that I was far better and far more interested in the theory.
Mm.
And then I was just reading theory, art theory books, which eventually becomes just reading theory and philosophy.
Sure.
And then when I finished, I was drawn towards the Continentals more than anyone because I found that actually they had more practical advice hidden away, strangely enough, even though that any stereotype of the Continentals would say the absolute opposite. But, I think in a certain sense that books like Anti-Oedipus and Discipline and Punish can be taken as manuals to a certain extent. So that was why, I didn't want to just study logic and, a certain, I wasn't interested in epistemology or ontology. I was interested in ideas in themselves and just continuously following something until it ended up somewhere.
Right. Absolutely. So bringing up those two books in particular,
mm-hmm.
Anti-Oedipus, the Thousand Plateaus series, and then Discipline and Punish, like
mm-hmm.
Guattari, and which I'm probably butchering his name, and obviously Foucault, both really had interest in the clinic at the time, the psychiatric and psychological machine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting you bring those up because Foucault, for good reason, had issues with the asylum and the mental health system, if you could even call it that at the time. But the talk of schizophrenia, and obviously in a cultural way rather than the disease, and sometimes,
yeah.
But it's very fascinating stuff. So what are your thoughts on what you've seen in modern day psychology? If that's too broad a question, we can limit it, but it's
well, no, I don't think it's too broad. If we tie it in with Anti-Oedipus. I'm not massive on Foucault's major works. I preferred the lectures and things.
Yeah.
But if we tie it into Anti-Oedipus, really we can look at psychiatry as well, quite simply an overarching Oedipal structure of wherein, let's take something I'm actually extremely averse to and skeptical of and almost hostile towards, which is CBT, which I think, cognitive behavioral therapy, which as far as I'm concerned is a plaster on top of a lot of problems for a lot of people. But at the same time, I think, I can roughly put it, of course I'm not a medical practitioner, but mm-hmm. roughly it seems that you're taught habits which elude and obscure and suffocate a supposed lack or idea or problem that you're having.
Mm.
So I'm going to have to, this is going to be quite a long answer, is if you have this lack or a problem, there's of course an implication of a structure, because if you have a problem that implies, if something is wrong, there's an implication of a hierarchy, because of course that would mean that certain ways of being are better than others.
Mm-hmm.
Same way of if you desire something or if you lack something, that also implies some form of consumptive or productive hierarchy, because of course there's things you want and there's things you don't want, or there's things you feel or believe you need. And Anti-Oedipus, as far as I can see, doesn't really, and within my readings, doesn't really investigate the specifics of these desires. It investigates the entire structure itself, whilst at the same time implying that the structure is no more or no less than a form of consumption and production. It's sort of mm-hmm. an auto-productive system.
Right.
So once you sort of understand that all of these things could have been just simply created or formed or produced in a cultural way, then these desires and lacks cease, or at least begin to cease. And I think CBT can just really be described. I mean, that's how I see modern psychology, by the way. That seems to be at the forefront of everything is CBT or variations of it. It just seems like an extremely like hyper-humanist way of dealing with things, what it doesn't do is take anything seriously which can't be subsumed into a sort of new atheist scientific framework or materialist framework as well. So, and I think it's important if someone comes and they're having some strange desires or some strange dreams, not to just simply say, well, they're odd, because that's implying that there's this norm that you need to, you know, draw back to. What's important is to go, well, let's investigate these things. Let's investigate this strange intuition or feeling that you're having and push into it. I think it's far more helpful. I'm not going to say healthier, and I'm not going to say unhelpful. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes it isn't helpful. Some people do genuinely just need to back away. But so that would be where my standpoint.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, I'm typing a few notes so I don't forget on some rejoinders to that answer, because it's fascinating to hear this. I am not a huge practitioner myself of CBT. CBT is the critical darling of the psychological and psychiatric world, because by necessity, because it was crafted in a lab, it's testable and replicable, right? It's something but some of the best things in the human experience aren't, in my opinion. So you have this metric that's set up, it's a stacked deck that favors CBT, because what's testing it are things that the clinic, okay, as a construct, have crafted, you know, outcome measures on if the thoughts have changed, different things like this. And I'm not completely dismissing CBT, but I specialize in working with people who have undergone trauma. And a lot of the time they know that they're safe in the present. They know that on a cognitive level, but they don't feel it. And so the subjective part there is having their nervous system catch up to their frontal lobe, and things like EMDR, so eye movement desensitization reprocessing. That's what I specialize in, so I'm biased, but therapies that are holistic and integrative and take into account that we are embodied, and that like the vagus nerve, the longest cranial nerve we have, runs through our face, our stomach, our digestive system. Like, it's responsible for a lot of our responses. It's like, that's not the frontal lobe. And CBT hits just that slice of human experience encapsulated by the frontal lobe. And it's like, we're missing this entire being when we focus just on those conscious thoughts.
Yeah.
It's myopic, really. So it's good to hear that you're aware that there's a much wider need for focus on other modalities. CBT was crafted by, I'm sure you know this, but for listeners, it was crafted by really anti-religious zealots. So if you've ever
heard... I don't think I even needed to know that, because it comes across...
It does.
It comes across intuitively that you're drawn away from anything which could remotely allude to something strange or spiritual or weird or different to just purely... It just felt like a straitjacket of normality.
Yes. It's really like, keep calm and continue your work, right? It's like, don't follow those dreams. That's not what you need to do. Don't literal dreams. Don't tease that.
Well, there's a problem there, because their conception of dreams, or let's say desires, is going to... So for instance, if someone went to CBT and said that they were having such an intense desire to go live in the woods, let's say that, or say someone went and they said that they were having such an intense desire to lay naked in fields all day. Mm-hmm. These are just far enough kind of over that normalcy gap where they'd, I think, CBT practitioners would sort of warn against this. They might not deter them, but there would be a sense of what they were doing is wrong. Instead of, and that entire, what Foucault would call a power structure,
right,
becomes of course a power structure wherein normalcy is created, and all of a sudden people who want what I can see as just not normal or not weird or not anything, people who want a desire to say, let's just go say live a primitive life in the woods, which I think quite a few people do, not loads, but quite a few, they begin to experience thoughts of doubt and guilt and things which wouldn't happen if they weren't sort of subconsciously subsuming themselves into the other's idea of normalcy, which is completely rebuilt and reinforced by things like CBT and the way schools are and the way education systems are. I mean, this is something that I'm really kind of thinking about a lot at the moment, which is, and it's from an old Rand Pryor essay where he talks about the fact that, I mean, if you're from the West, then chances are you spent 6 to 8 hours a day between the years of 4 and 18 sat behind a desk doing something you didn't really want to do under fluorescently lit light, and mm-hmm. basically having a strange form of authority mm-hmm. given to you as a priori, as if that's the only option. But because it's given across to you as if it's the absolute norm from day one, of course, when your brain's very plastic, when you're younger, you don't just believe this, you believe this entirely. It's not some form of like faith where you're really hanging on to the idea that it's true. It's absolute belief for many people, I think. And to doubt it doesn't even crack people's shell anymore. It just goes kind of through them. They won't listen to it. And there's an idea in there that, well, what's that, you know, 8 hours for every day for 16 years done to people? And it's done this, you know, it's made us able to do things like office work. It's made us able to not question the fact that most jobs are just complete abstraction.
Beautiful. Yes. So I recommend heavily to anyone the Exiting Modernity series that you crafted. It's divided into chapters. Toward the middle, I believe, is where we get into how the school system is introduced early in life as a constricting mechanism. And then when we exit that, any modicum of freedom we receive in addition to that, we're like, oh, you're an adult now, you are free, in quotes, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Really, it's like that fan theory that the whole Matrix movie, like when they escape the Matrix, they've never actually escaped it. They just think that they have, and Zion is still taking place in just a different level of it. I thought of that immediately, because what's happening is there's a constricting structure that's overly powerlessness inducing, and then we get into one that's where they wanted us all along, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like that exactly. tactic of you start off with a really ridiculous demand, and then something smaller on a psychological level is more palatable, because someone's like, oh, by comparison, that's not, it's all unconscious, of course, but like, oh, this is not that bad, because there's that tension of tension that release.
Yeah, but then even what's strange is even things like filling up your car and paying taxes and, say, doing the shopping, people, especially when that's new to them, many, many people, even in their later years, in their 50s and 60s, you still hear them say things like, oh, I just went shopping, or, oh, I've got to fill up the car. And you can sense this idea that what they're doing is proper and correct and adult, and there's no questioning of whether or not they're using their time well, or whether or not they actually want to do this. And there's a sort of sense of pride in their normalcy. And, you know, it's just going from one cage into another, really. I don't, you know.
Yes, absolutely. That's a great way of describing it. There's kind of a pride in adulting, that term, which I really don't. I
don't think there's a term I loathe more.
Good. Oh, that's great. Because I was going to ask you if you had any particular egregious pet peeves culturally, what's going on now, like least favorite TV series or trends?
I really don't watch much TV.
Well, of course. Well, that's great.
I'm just trying to think of if I've seen anything lately that I thought. You know, I don't mind rom-coms and things which aren't trying to be much. What I tend to loathe is something that anything political, I think, on television, I just, even if I'm in some sort of agreement with it, I'll tend to back away because it's so ham-fisted and just like obnoxious that I just can't really be bothered with it. And since coming to the conclusion that a lot of TV is really pushing elements of violence and hostility onto society kind of subconsciously, I don't really want much to do with it. In terms of how I watch TV, I enjoy watching absolutely anything on random TV with other people, right, and just laughing about it in a sort of absurd way. I enjoy that. But in terms of trends, there's many, but adulting is one that I've actually written about before, there's so many problems with adulting, but it's that faux idea that suddenly you're X or Y and that changes everything. But also there's this problem with adulting that, well, why don't you just do those things? And a lot of the things that people are on about when they're on about adulting, like, oh, I had to do my washing today and then pay my taxes, and then they're just things that I think anyone with half a brainstem should be able to do. I mean, I don't have extremely high standards for people yet. I'm still disappointed most of the time. but we're not really allowed to say that. I mean, I don't particularly care. I'm not in any position where it's gonna bite me in the ass. But
right,
of course, we're not allowed to say, you know, when someone gets a 20,000 retweeted tweet about moaning about having to go to the shop and buy dinner and then do the laundry. We're
right.
not allowed to say, well, maybe you should just, you know, get on with it.
Right.
You know, there's not much more I can say about adulting other than that these people are kind of eternal infants, I think. You know, I'm not a massive fan of his, but he does have the occasional fairly astute comment. But one of the things Jordan Peterson mentions is that the age for men and women where you used to kind of mature used to be from kind of between 14 and 18. It was fairly quick and it was fairly hard. And now actually it seems to be between about 18 and 25, if not 30.
Yeah, probably 30.
Yeah. And I don't particularly think that generation themselves is to blame for that. I mean, of course, they can't really entirely be because they're not the ones who brought themselves up. But also at the same time, there's so many structures in society now which are attempting to keep you consistently as a child that you do wonder how much you have actually matured or have made this transition to adulthood. And I think most of that is down to either fatigue or self-analysis and self-awareness. I think
absolutely. The infantilization essentially of society, we can look at, again, going back to your essay about exiting modernity, mm-hmm. there's such an enablement of that when the state holds your hand through everything and then says, now you're ready for this little job here where you have a very repetitive set of non-critical thinking skills that you have to exhibit. Okay, maybe now you're ready for a little bit less automation in your job and maybe a little bit more room for critical thought. Like, all along the way, there's never a quantum leap or a massive developmental hurdle where people have to come to a really authentic answer on their own, which is how development is formed, by the way. And so we have people like you, people like other creators out there who've decided to go on this journey themselves, right? Maybe some big thing. And we'll get into this. I really want to talk about how you witnessed your own town become subsumed by the capitalistic machinations. But the ability to critically think is not reinforced. So therefore, any kind of step toward being adult is taken as this massive leap that to others who, for whatever reason, have discovered it's not that massive, right? Who've discovered that maybe you just get on with it. We roll our eyes at that. It's like, what led to that? What societal turn led to that? Well, greater responsibility of the state, parents maybe not being as invested in their kids because they have their own selfish.
Well, parents didn't have to be. That was one of the first problems, you know. And the state had this implication that their way was the best way. And so did, I think, job structures as well worked very much in the same way as schools, you know, things like apprenticeships and things along those lines. So there was an idea that if there wasn't some bureaucratic official paperwork behind it, that why would you allow that person or that collective to you know, bring your child up? There has to people love officialness. It's like an abstract safety net, but there's not, you know, there's very little behind it.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it reminds me of the Eddie Izzard skit where he is saying, well, we've got a flag. That means we own this land. We've got a flag. Do you have a flag? It's like any kind of veneer of officialness, any kind of veneer of bureaucratic legitimacy, right, is what people can take.
You know what? I don't mind. I'm going to be kind of a bit pedantic on that one.
Good,
I don't mind the sort of someone taking something and doing it in a way of really almost Machiavellian power. That I almost think is somewhat intriguing and exciting, and in a certain sense justified, because maybe justified is the wrong word, but in a certain sense it's like determinist. And I think that person has taken it, and
right.
My problem with the official bureaucratic thing is it sort of utilizes the passivity of its audience. It's not very sly about it, and everyone can see it, and it's extremely clunky. And I just think that something like that isn't worthy of doing this. You know, it's a fascism in not even, you know, if I'm gonna have to live under some sort of fascist bureaucratic constraints, at least make the aesthetics nice. You know, at least make it clear. I'd rather have jackboots outside my house than, you know, two traffic wardens who are passive aggressively telling me some new rules, or you know, another 30 mile an hour speed limit sign on a road where there's already four in the space of, you know, 50 meters, because, you know, people have to be told to slow it down. And it's stuff like that that I just think it's so pathetic. But that's just a personal grief.
No, I understand what you're saying. It's the incongruence between, it's the dissonance between stated reasons for something in the actual system, and it's what you talk about.
Yeah, either act like a government that doesn't have to give reasons,
yes,
or give very clear ones, and the middle ground is sort of like, well, you know, it's just frustrating.
Absolutely, that's a great way to put it. It's kind of the velvet glove over the iron fist. It's that, which is just such a marketed way. It's just death by degrees. It's like all of a sudden the friendly officials, you've ceded more power to them and there's nothing left. And it's a very different aesthetic. I get what you're saying. It's a very different approach than the fascism of yesteryear.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on, so with your, jumping around a little bit here, your essay on real life LARPing, or, well, that's redundant. Your thing about LARPing and a real LARP, that's what it's called. Pulling it up here.
Yeah.
It's about sincerity and embracing whatever ideology you have, and against modernism's shrieks that it's regressive. What inspired
that? What inspired that was a lot of people on Twitter sort of bellowing their beliefs. I'm going to have to put that in quotation marks. A lot of Catholics and a lot of occultists and a lot of new spiritual people and a lot of meditators and a lot of Buddhists. And the problem was that, as far as I can see, that as soon as you start saying how much you believe something, it's very clear that your form of belief is sort of false. Because if you have to say that you believe it and constantly kind of tout and toot that you do, it's clear that your belief isn't really faith in the true sense. So the idea that you're adhering to is you're doing it for a certain sort of agenda or reason. Mm. And the LARPing thing, you know, live action role playing is when people pretend to be certain things.
Right.
And modernity makes it seem as if anything that's outside of its power structure is these people aren't serious about it. Where I live, there's still occasionally Morris dancers do their thing, and people wouldn't take that serious as a tradition. I'm not sure of the origins of it, but I'm sure that there is some spiritual origins there. People wouldn't even think of it in that way. They'd just go, oh, look, they're doing the silly dance because they think it's silly. And I think that way of thinking, same for instance, you know, some druids went to the local woods and did some practice there. People wouldn't think, oh, there's some sincere pagans or druids doing their thing. They would think, who are those kooky lot in the woods? It must be a festival or show. You know, there's everything gets subsumed back into some form of normalcy, which is getting tighter and tighter. Whether or not we have all these multiple genders and multiple pronouns, that's just sort of the same fractal spiraling out from an extremely small node within an ever tightening form of normalcy, which is going to implode. And that was why some of my predictions were, you know, things will come back like Satanism and occultism, and you're going to see a big rise in a lot of very specific alternative ideologies, especially in the next 10 years, because it's just, you know, that you can only get something so tight before people eventually just kind of crack. And we're already seeing this, you know, the left's already done this to the right, and you're seeing more and more people just not really care about tolerance and hurting people, because there's only so long you can stand still before one of the borders of tolerance and normalcy eventually is gonna, you know, hit you when it tightens. And that's what a lot of people are finding, that okay, actually no, I can't agree with that now. I can't go that far in your direction, so I'm gonna stop. And as soon as you do that, you find yourself kind of up against the wall fairly quick.
The law of psychological reactance is at play here, where the more you tell someone what to do, the more resentment they develop. The pendulum swings the other way. And so it's interesting to consider the delegitimation of any sort of belief system beyond that of work 40 hours a week for 40 years and die has really produced some backlash, predictably so, for anyone who's watching critically, such as yourself. Did you see Midsommar? Did you see that movie?
Yeah.
I'm thinking of that, and I'm thinking of the egregiousness that the audience, which I have to admit, I've seen my share of horror movies for sure, but the suicide scene of the elders, which even using that term, it's like they viewed their life as well lived potentially, and that was their cultural framework. But to us,
that's a good example. Yeah,
to us, thank you to the idea of any sort of ritual around determining the end of one's life or any system that is greater than life itself. Viewing a system of belief as greater than individual life is very baked into our philosophy.
Yeah, why would anything you do be more important than just being the individual and consuming? Right.
Than another day of consumption.
Yeah. Exactly.
So I really encourage anybody out there listening to the Wisecrack podcast has probably heard this argument before, because they discuss the meaning of that movie in terms of our society, and even a surface level examination of it's pretty helpful, because you see these people who are the very embodiment of Western society going into kind of the ancient context of Western society, which I think really helps it out, because you can't otherize it, to use an unwieldy phrase, like going to an Asian country or something. But this is what Western society used to be, right? We're contrasting the pre-modern with the modern to post-modern eras. Mm-hmm. And the lack in both of those of, like, there's pros and cons. It's not great to leap from a rock and die, but is it great to live a slower death that is being turned up by degrees, like we're talking about? Mm-hmm. Which is kind of what psychology and the psychiatric establishment gives you pills to deal with, right? when maybe you do need to go live out in the woods for a while and drop out.
Well, not just that as well. The thing with the kind of the overprescription of drugs is that there's an implication that what you're feeling isn't okay. And right. Usually it's because what you're feeling stops you being productive. Mm. And I think there's something to be said for, well, as long as, well, not even that. I mean, if someone's emotions get them to the point where they get to the point where they want to kill themselves, the usual reason that we're stopping it is because we want them to be X and Y. We want them to be a certain type of member of society. And it's sort of like, well, if that person doesn't want to be that and their emotions take them to that certain way, then who are we to say otherwise? And, you know, perhaps move away from depression and mm-hmm. people who are going to end their lives. But let's say, you know, I don't know, people who are manic or people who are, I don't know, have other people who are maybe perpetually lazy or procrastinate or something along those lines, where all of these are targeted in a certain sense towards production or consumption. And all the tablets, of course, are about bringing you back towards a base level where you can just be the cog. And there's something to be said for, well, why can't people just have their emotions? You know, it's sort of like there's an unspoken expectancy that people don't just kind of break down crying or laughing or running in the streets, or there's an unspoken sort of rule that you don't skip around or sprint around town or say spin around or anything along those lines. But as soon as you ask what's wrong with that, people will just say, well, it's just not something you do. And then of course you get into the whole, well, why? And people will say, well, it's not normal, it's weird. And really it's just a form of kind of repression, isn't it? You know, I think if you ask the average person, you'd find that most people, when they're left to their own devices in their own homes, probably dance around like maniacs, or maybe even lie completely still in silence, which is something else that's extremely difficult to do. But this is of course all tied to some notion of production, because consumption. Because if you said to someone, I'm going to go to the park, they say, are you going for a run or a walk, or are you going to go, play cricket? And if you said, well, I'm just going to go to the park and sit there for a while, that's not normal. But why?
Exactly. Why is that not normal? Books that tell you how to do simple living or go hang out at the park. Thank you. I needed a book that told me how to sit on a bench, because damn it, I didn't know how.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't have a massive problem with these books, because I think it's poignant.
Yes.
We need a book. It's poignant that we need a book to tell us to do that.
Yeah.
And the fact that we've had so much programmed into us before we're an adult implies that, you know, we do need a book, because it's those books are just forms of deprogramming, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it's yeah.
I love it. I love that we're turning toward that. I have to say, any steps I toward deprogramming the system of sit in a cubicle, sit in a desk, whatever, I am behind. I've recommended such books to clients. It's just fascinating to take a step back.
I'm behind them, as long as those people don't get subsumed into another guru or ideology.
That's my problem.
Which happens most of the time, because a lot of people get pulled into some new mindful thing or some new meditative technique or something along those lines. And it's unfortunate that most people don't have the analytical skills to realize when they're going from one ideology to another.
It is sad to think about that. And you see that parallel a lot in the addictions world. Someone who is at risk of or has been addicted seriously to some kind of illicit drug or alcohol or what have you, going really far into that straight edge community and everything being like eating, drinking, sleeping, the AA, Alcoholics Anonymous world, right?
I think this, the term straight edge is kind of, it's useful. I mean, I don't identify as one, but as far as I'm concerned by the definition, I am one. I mean, all I have is one cup of coffee a day. I don't smoke and I haven't drunk in like 4 years, and don't do drugs. So I'm as Timmy Turtle as you can get, really.
There you go.
Probably surprising for the things I write about. But what was I going to say? So, straight edge and like, I don't know, you could call it contemporary asceticism or something like that. I'm kind of dubious to those names, like you said, because instantly you're pulling yourself back into some idea and some form of creating an identity. And it's actually something a good friend of mine messaged me the other day, which was something his brother said to him, which was, you don't form your identity around what you do, but what you don't do. So even not doing something can become some form of identity. And I think the real thing to do is to break out of, the first thing to do perhaps is to find a way to break out of the idea that almost everything you do needs to be some form of social or personal proof. You know, it's okay to do things just to do things. You don't always have to be productive. You don't have to be productive in certain ways. You don't have to consume certain things. It's okay to go home and mull out. It's okay to go home and, you know, stand in the garden. It's very difficult to get this message across, because people usually listen to this and all they really do is take this as a way to buy something different, or, you know, they don't, you know, it's quite difficult to get to the real meat of what it is that you're content doing.
Absolutely. I like that your blogs, the Exiting Modernism series in particular, really get into walking people through that and saying, if you imagine yourself without your vices, which I think is an important thought experiment, and there doesn't seem to be much left, well, don't fret, because there is. It just may take some time to excavate.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Well, this is sort of my MO, really, for anything in life is, and I mentioned this, I recently was interviewed by Jason Horsley again, and there's a Picasso quote where he says it took him his whole life to learn how to paint like a child. And basically I always took that as that, you know, you to run through them briefly, as soon as you're born, you're put into the what Deleuze, you know, the mama puppy triad of, mama papa. I don't know what that Freudian slip is. I must really want a dog.
Nice.
I think so. I do. I really want an Australian Shepherd. So.
That sounds badass. But,
mama puppy. I'm going to have to think about that one. Anyway, the mama papa triad of Oedipal and authoritative, parental authoritative guidance, which kind of stays with you pretty much forever unless you really look into it. And then of course you're put into schools where you believe that the authoritarian teacher is the be all and end all, and you also learn at that point that life is regimented into blocks, and you eat your lunch at certain times even though you might not be hungry at that time, and you have to run around at certain times even though you might not want to run around at certain times,
right?
And you're a child and you have to sit down all day even though that's absolutely not what you want to do when you're a child, alongside learning various things which you would have learned anyway because that's just how it is. And then of course you go through different schools like this, which each constrain you in different ways, less physically and then more mentally near the end. And then once that structure is in place, you're ready for the world of work and the world of promotions and the world that, and then all these things build up. And I think there's certain subtle forms of trauma in a way, and eventually you have all this. And really the task of anyone who's coming to things like this podcast or Exiting Modernity is to strip back straight away. Is how much can you strip back? Because you will learn a lot about yourself in an extremely short amount of time if you can strip away as much as possible.
Yes, which we're really discussing here, the idea of mindful observation, of just witnessing the present non-judgmentally for what it is, recognizing what your motivations are, really leaning into whatever sensations you have when you have the urge to purchase something. I like that you include exercises that help people to recognize why am I experiencing this urge to do this thing.
Yeah. So follow it to its root, and you really,
right,
you usually realize that the root dissipates pretty quickly and there was nothing there in the first place.
Absolutely. That it was a programmed sort of need, like with what we're talking about CBT. It's like, if you have a thought distortion, if there's a list of thought distortions, then that CBT is crafted, then they have the prescription, right? It's self-reinforcing. So you may just be at the whims of whatever product you feel you need, like a new iPhone. Well, why? Let's look at it. Well, maybe yours has two cameras, or God forbid one, when the new one has like three on it, right? And so there's that social proof component of comparing oneself to an in-group. And you can argue there's an evolutionary psychology component to that tribal belonging. But since those times, time immemorial, we've been trying to surpass that and learn that there's more to belonging than our totems, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
What I did is I went through your blog and I made some questions. I put them under different passages because there's so much stuff to comment on here. Mm-hmm. The idea of Oz being behind the curtain, being modernity, right? And currently we're admiring his tricks. I thought so much of that movie, A Scanner Darkly. Have you seen that one?
No, I did. I started it and I just thought it was the most pretentious load of twaddle I've ever seen.
It is very pretentious. I will tell you that. I mean, it has pre-Iron Man Robert Downey Jr., which he
it's
was...
Richard Linklater, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, the main character played by Keanu Reeves is both an addict to this drug in his off time and someone speaking out against it. And the thing is, he doesn't know it because this drug creates like a gap in consciousness. And toward the end of the movie, we realize that the drug and the rehab centers are hand in hand, right? So you've got like the drug is the problem that's induced, and then here's the cure. So I immediately thought of that sort of dichotomy.
Well, I mean, an advert creates an anxiety which is relievable by purchase. That's
right.
A David Foster Wallace quote. I mean, but the problem is, it's a desire that wasn't there in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, behind all the desires is just nothing. And I think that's probably what people are running away from, but you shouldn't run away from it. You should throw yourself headlong into it, really.
Yes. And witness it, allow it to pass through like a wave. I think that's why it's so important to look at a delusion version of desire, like that desire is actual an energy being projected outward versus that of a lack. And we were getting at this of like 30 minutes ago, you brought this up, like desire as an absence versus an energy.
The difficulty with Deleuzian desire is that it's part of an autocatalytic or autoproductive system. So you have to understand that we're already in the middle of a machinic process.
Yes.
So within that, of course, is implications of lacking in freedom. Of course, you can kind of spiral off a little bit individually. But if you're already in the middle of a process which was started long ago, of course, the cogs are already, everything's already in play. So as far as desires go, you know, it's whatever fires off in the machine. And of course, it's just not of much use.
Right. And that's where you get people who are past Deleuze, looking forward, trying to go into how to actually make sense of these concepts in a way that's constructive and more applicable. Go ahead.
I would say look at Deleuze's biography if you want to see how to make them practical, which is don't go to conferences and sit around, chain smoke roll-ups and read books all day. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think he understood that.
Right.
And that was probably where a lot, I mean, I probably need to read a bit more Deleuzian biography, but it's my understanding that he's an extremely laid-back chap, sort of like a Duchamp figure. And you know, the anti-conference stance really interests me because it makes me it helps me understand that he simply just enjoyed writing these works and not for some sort of academic social credit. And you know, there's the practical advice. That's what you should.
The less pressure we put on ourselves for the finished product, paradoxically, the better.
I have no problem people putting pressure on themselves to achieve great things. Just question why you're doing it. Is it because you enjoy the thing in itself, in which case go for it? Or is it because you have a secondary agenda which you're not admitting to, which is the usual case? And I believe that's why most businesses fail, you know, because people want the money or the customers or something else first, and they don't want the other thing, you know, the quality or the actual idea, the product, the thing that needs to be done. Same way I think a lot of books don't get written is because a lot of people want to say they've written a book, but they don't actually want to write one.
Yeah, I think you should probably have something to say before trying to say it. You know, just things like that, beyond status seeking.
Yeah, exactly.
Your list of facts that you shared around New Year's was great. I like number 62, post-apocalyptic media is largely fantasy.
Oh, yeah, it is. I mean, we'd all love it. We'd all love a reset, I think. You'd find very few people other than the 1% who wouldn't love a reset. And at the same, I think the reason that most post-apocalyptic stuff is fantasy is because really what the underlying idea of post-apocalyptic is that you suddenly have all your freedom back instantly. You know,
right.
your life is now in your hands. And we're back to basics, and it pushes an extremely simple premise that basically you're free again. And I think we'd all love that, because in abstract, I don't think we'd love the reality, but there's a reason why it's so popular. And there's a reason I think people love seeing decaying and overgrown streets. And it's sort of perhaps they don't think it would actually happen, but I think there's a reason people keep going to these things.
Yeah, The Walking Dead in particular, I think of, because it starts out as this collaborative survival show about surviving with your small tribe that's under Dunbar's number, right? Or the number, like 150, which is what we can save, like the connections we can have with others.
Yeah.
Then it gets into this sort of fantasy of agrarian culture whenever the survivors.
And now you mention that, that's actually when the series went extremely downhill.
Bingo. Yeah. Right.
Series 4 or 5.
Once
they sort of began finding big settlements, you realize, well, the large freedom is gone. We've put yourself back in the system that you had before, which probably wasn't perfect. I think it would have been more interesting if they'd have gone and found, I don't know, a coven of witches, or they'd gone to a libertarian society or something along those lines. You know, I think there's a frustration there that the first society they find just basically adheres to democratic contemporary American standards of living, and it's sort of like, oh, well, the whole tension of the show is kind of over.
Exactly. Yeah. So from a narrative perspective, from any lens you want to look at.
Which is why, even though it wasn't done as well as in the comics, actually, when Negan came along, it's one of my favorite episodes of the show. It's probably one of the worst rated, but you know, it's been out a long time now, so I'll spoil it. But it was fantastic to see a show put a lineup of major characters and then literally cave two main characters' heads in with a bat and have a villain sort of actually have a very villainy stance and just be able to do what they wanted. And I thought actually they handled it terribly, as they have done for the past about 4 seasons, but but it the idea itself of finally a villain that sort of can just walk in and smash the narrative, I was like, well, yeah, finally, you know, something that's brought back any form of tension which isn't sort of ham-fisted.
Precisely. Yeah, it's interesting to put the lens of the hunter-gatherer society of survival there at the beginning versus the agrarian turn. So what do you think about that very, I'll say, very wild view of that Neolithic society where people settled down and started eating grains and stopped fasting and stopped moving as much? So essentially the turn from hunter-gatherer society to agrarian farming society was bad, was a net negative for humanity.
Well, if this is kind of Kaczynski in thought and primitivist thought, and as far as I'm concerned, if we're going to rely on data of whether or not that it was good, I mean, if you're talking about this in terms of modernity and starting some form of idea of abstract production, that we have to be productive, then yeah, it was bad. But if you're talking about it in terms of standards of living and things like that, well, we don't have much data, and we have hardly any data about Neolithic society. So any primitivist claim is on fairly loose legs. I mean, I have nothing against them. I'm sort of, you know, if you want to go do that, then do that. I think that people should be free. I think there should almost be a people who want to do that should just be allowed to, I don't know, live in national parks. I think that's entirely within everyone's right to say, actually, no, you know what, I didn't kind of choose to be in this, and I don't particularly want to be. But as far as whether or not it may, you know, that balances on definitions of bad and good, really, doesn't it? And
yes,
it's sort of an unfalsifiable thing and extremely abstract. So I'm more focused on more the realist thing of, well, you've got this situation, so what can I do to kind of help people who are feeling the same way I did years ago?
Right. So did you hear about the person who fell into a hot spring at Yellowstone and dissolved?
That's yeah,
national park.
Yeah,
like, well, there you go.
But that shouldn't be news. I think, you know, that's someone fell into a hot spring, and I get it, of course, but I think it's wrong to, I mean, I live in rural England. I see dead animals on the road all the time, so, and that would probably be absurd to many people, but you know, seeing a deer splaying over the road, or you know, is with guts everywhere and etc isn't, you know, that's been a normal thing for me for many years. And I think city dwellers, I don't know, because I don't really go to cities very often. But there seems to be an impression that, you know, the fact that someone falling into a hot spring and dying is news is kind of sort of like someone fell off a cliff and died. It's sort of like that reminder of like, well, yeah, you know, nature, not everything's been suffocated by the modern structure yet. So you can still die, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I think I probably relate to the animals on the road bit a little more than other metropolitan dwellers, because I grew up in the South, the American South, obviously. Mm-hmm. And there's a bit more nature there. I'm in Denver, Colorado now, and it's a little bit of a different beast, just to put it mildly. People like to build vertically here and have less backyards and things that are the concrete jungle is a term that comes to mind. Mm-hmm. So the Walking Dead, I just love that I saw you put post-apocalyptic media as fantasy. I think people, that's a good way to unplug. Like, why do you like this? Okay, because there's tension. Okay, get deeper. What tension? What does that represent? It's like, you want to go explore this. Okay, now unplug further from the matrix. Go take some time to go plug in without society having to collapse around you.
Yeah, exactly that.
Yes. Okay. Infinite Jest is really good. I'm looking at that. That's it. So you
Infinite Jest was one of those first books where I read it, and I read it twice, and I absolutely adored it. I remember thinking it was really, really original. And that thread was a thread of unpopular opinions, like genuine unpopular ones, because there's this sort of undercurrent within intellectual Twitter and intellectual world to kind of shit on David Foster Wallace, because he's this, you know, he had this certain personality. But at the same time, who's that Western canon literary critic? He said like David Foster Wallace had no discernible talent. I just remember thinking it's an extremely original book, and I just want to say, you know what, no, like, I think it's taking a lot of people, sort of, they were jumping through hoops to be able to prove that it was bad. And same with House of Leaves, you know, and I just thought, no, these two books are good, just kind of admit it. If I read a genuine critique, and you know, there's massive bits of Infinite Jest that I don't think are needed, but it's been a while since I really read any Foster Wallace, but
yeah, right.
Still, yeah. I'd really enjoy it. It's one of my first literary obsessions. I quite enjoyed him.
Yeah, I definitely understand that. Let's talk about, jump around a little bit here, what kindled your interest in the occult?
Blimey.
I mean, philosophy and the occult are very closely related.
Yeah, they're kind of close. I think it was John Michael Greer, because what happened was I was going to interview him about collapse, and I knew that at the moment he's more interested in the occult, so I kind of did some questions for that as well, and then ended up being interested in myself. And then it was also a recent turn understanding Kantianism in a certain light and understanding that certain things are real. So that was spanning from the work of Nick Land and the things that demons can be real in a certain sense, and then from that sort of understanding occultism. And but I don't personally have too much to do with the occult in my personal life anymore. In fact, I'm kind of backing away from it. Yeah,
I can understand that. I just saw in your top five books, one of them was
Aleister Crowley's biography.
Yes.
Yeah.
What did you think?
Well, the reason I put that in there isn't because I think Aleister Crowley was a despicable man and probably was. No. Even
I agree.
That biography is written by someone who studies Thelema, you know, Richard Kaczynski, and someone who studied Thelema that I believe their whole life and is obviously a big fan of Crowley, and it doesn't paint him in a good light, and it's extremely dense and extremely well researched. So I don't think, you know, there's any way that anyone, even these fans, could really say actually he was an all right guy. There's a couple of moments in there where he's kind of loving towards his daughter, but other than that, he was generally not satanic, I don't want to say that, not just sort of villainy evil, you know, slicing goats' throats open and doing lots of sex, magic and drugs, but also very psychotic and sociopathic and just not a nice person, extremely kind of privileged. And but the reason I put that in there is because it, despite the fact I hated Crowley, it's a fantastic book and one of the best biographies I've ever read in terms of,
wow,
you know, I was enthralled the whole time. And I even had the expanded edition, which has loads of random details in, and there's some just generally fantastic documentation. I just thought in terms of just being a good book, it was great.
And I remember also in your podcast with Greer, you had a book that you were interested in and asking him about, like an intro to
the occult. Initiation into Hermetics?
Yes. I think that was it.
By Franz Bardon, yeah.
Yes. Did you enjoy it? Did you find it illuminating?
Yeah, that was the system I practiced for a short time. And to be radically, I'll try to be as honest as possible. My intuition went through the roof to the point where things started to get weird. So I sort of stopped.
You got red pilled too hard, friend.
No.
Just kidding.
No, not red pilled. It was genuinely quite strange, and you sort of attract a lot of stuff that you don't want to attract. And that was why I sort of drew back to Christianity, actually.
Yeah, brilliant segue, because I did want to ask about the role that faith is playing in your life. I think it's awesome that you're exploring the early church fathers, especially in that cool book on your reading list there.
Sayings of the Desert. Desert Fathers, yeah.
Desert Fathers.
Early Christian monks.
Yes.
Faith is a difficult one, because any sincere faith isn't belief, is it? When people start talking about evidence, you know, and I went through a long new atheist phase, which is quite frankly the dumbest phase of my life, but I'm glad I got it out of the way.
Right.
When you start talking about facts and evidence, you realize that the faith, the kind of ontologically, the realm of faith and the realm of evidence and facts are two separate things. You can't, if you need evidence for something, then you're not faithful, because faith is just pure faith, you know.
Right.
It's belief in something so undoubtedly that you don't need those things, and that's something where I believe your intuition comes in and your understanding. And the more I headed back towards Christ and the Christian way of living, the better my life got, and the more calm my life got, and the calmer it is now, which is why I've sort of really distanced myself from occultism, because it doesn't, you have to be an extremely strong-willed person to be able to deal with any of that, and if you're not, if you're sort of fairly plodding along like myself, who's quite happy to just be content, it's not, you know, it's not something you should really dip into. And also, like Greer said, I kind of dipped my toe. I didn't go as, you know, if you're going to do it, you should really go for it, and I didn't, but I'm glad I didn't. So faith at the moment is just sort of reading the Bible and getting on by, really.
That's wonderful. I think we need a lot of, as a Christian myself, I think we need people who are the embodiments of kind of that scholar, philosopher faith.
In short, I sort of had an experience where once you realize that evil can exist, you come to understand quite quickly that good exists. And once you understand how evil operates, you realize you don't want to be around it very quickly. And you find, and you sort of withdraw. The intuition of evil is a strange thing.
If that's such a fascinating topic, if you don't want to get into details, you don't have to, but.
No, go ahead. Ask
I would just like, what did you encounter that made you pull back from the cults, and what did you experience?
See, of course, people will have in their minds that I saw some kind of demon or something. It doesn't exactly work like that. What happens is you're sort of playing parlor games with the cosmos, and so I mean the Franz Bardon system isn't, you're not really doing much with demons or anything like that. You're doing meditations and things on what the cultists call the ethereal plane. But my intuition of things became so strange that I became paranoid. So by intuition, I mean when I was reaching into a box and I needed, say, 9 of something, I which I do fairly often because I'm a full-time joiner, so I pick up screws out of boxes. And what was happening is every time I reached into the box, I'd say need 6 screws, or next time I'd need 9. Every time I did that for about 3 weeks running, I got the exact number without looking, which starts as a coincidence, and eventually you start getting kind of weird about it. But also the stranger ones were sort of driving and understanding that you should slow your car down at certain points, or you should go down a certain road because there's someone you haven't seen for a while that you want to see. And there was a hideous amount of moments like that, which many people would say, well, that sounds good, but eventually you kind of go, well, if the universe is giving me all this, you know, you can't, it's give and take. So, and then eventually you get very exhausted and kind of start slipping a bit, and then that's where I backed away, because I thought, actually, no, this isn't for me. And I think occultism's kind of entropic. Once you sort of start, you need to keep it up, otherwise you kind of get sucked under. And so one of the things I said to Jason Horsley is, as much as I love John Michael Greer, I think he is an anomaly. I think most people practicing occultism are, you know, eviler than thou or more powerful than thou type people who want power and money and fame. And there's not many nice people in it, unfortunately. He would disagree, but this is just personal experience. And then you just get this overwhelming sense that not something, but sort of space is sort of out to get you in a certain way. And you realize that there's some real horrible dark stuff out there that you don't, if you can, you don't want to let in. And it's sort of, it's made me a lot kinder and a lot more caring, because it's sort of given me an extremely, a much deeper sense of understanding when it comes to what evil can do to people and how it's affected people. And you sort of see it in certain places, and you know, I still have the occasional sort of intuition of certain areas or certain people. I think, you know, there's something going on there.
Wow. Anything specific that you observed or noticed?
In what way?
Just like the dark forces are noticing that evil exists.
You get it quite a lot in rooms. You sort of can walk in and you can just tell. I mean, that's intuition. A lot of people block it out, I think. Or they'll go, oh, no, I'm just being silly. But, you know, there's a reason that certain things have triggered and fired off in your mind and body as to why you're feeling that way.
Absolutely. Yeah. Wow. I'm kind of going backwards here, but I want to ask, like, your essay does a great job of explaining this, and I'll direct people toward that, obviously, the one about exiting modernity. But the modernity itself, where do you see it starting and ending? Because it seems like we're referring to modernity even extending now, and people sometimes say that now we're just in post-modernity. So what are your...
The clearest way to say when modernity started is when the numeric system came into play when we moved from qualification into qualification.
That's earlier than the age of enlightenment, where people often
I'd say about when that really happened. I mean, there's to start thinking in atomized ways as opposed to in quality or reasons or meanings why you do something as opposed to productive capability.
Okay, the atomized way of thinking. And
so people become atomized, and instead of seeking quality or meaning or reasons or personal reasons for doing things, they think of everything in terms of a productivity and number and productivity.
Right, and so we've kind of hurtled too far into that extreme. What do you think about metamodernity, the idea of now things not being dualistic and about that play of opposites, but about the integration of absurdity, essentially?
Metamodernity is one of those terms, much like, I don't know, late capitalism. It's like, yes. No, modernity seems to just subsume everything into it. I think it's sort of like postmodernism. It's like you've tried to escape too soon, and now you've left with this free-floating signifier, which just is a bit of a lame term. I think we all know that modernity isn't over. We all know that, in a certain sense, modernism isn't even over. And we all know that capitalism isn't over. So being a bit more realist about these things. So I don't really think much about meta-modernity now.
Yeah, I definitely understand. I kind of figured you'd have a nuanced opinion on that. Like, it's kind of a bit of a stopgap thing. What do you, when you talk about the idea of living as a neo-ascetic, that's really striking, because you're proposing a way that really doesn't expect people to drop everything, right? You understand that they can't always do that, but introducing some mindfulness is always possible.
Yeah. I mean, I think this probably would be a good place to end, but this will be a long...
Yes.
The neo-asceticism thing is one of the extremely important parts of exiting modernity. Because, I mean, of course, an ascetic is someone who removes themselves from pleasure, which is such an abhorrent view in terms of modernity, because our entire modus operandi is targeted towards hedonism and pleasure and excitement and entertainment. Everything we you know, the reason we work is largely towards that, or for base comforts. But our base comforts, food, water, air, shelter, are so easy now that, well, we've become kind of bored. I mean, Ted Kaczynski comments on this. The neo-ascetic is sort of, it's a silly term, because of course I don't like the whole neo thing, but it's also it's like an understanding of the ascetic within modern society. So it's not saying we'd have to become complete ascetics and go down to the river and live in robes or anything like that, but it is saying that you can live an extremely minimal life that is content and fine. And there's nothing wrong with not being entertained 24/7, because most people's food is entertainment. Most people's bus journeys are entertainment on their phones. Most people's everything, when you've come to think about it, even their clothing is entertainment.
Right.
And you don't have to do that. And you don't have to do that. So the neo-ascetic is sort of, when you go to shops, I think consciously about it and think, you know, am I hungry? Am I entertained? Am I this? Am I that? Instead of just buying into your latest thing. And really, the quick way to do this is, it doesn't even need to be meditation. It's just contemplation, just sitting for a while and thinking on things, or journaling, or going for a walk, or just being. I've said this many, many times, and most people who've ever listened to me on podcasts are probably getting very bored of it. But just being is absolutely fine.
Absolutely. That's a wonderful stopping point here. So as we wrap up here, are there any upcoming projects or anything that you want to direct people toward?
The Hermetics is still going, and other than that, no, like I'm I'll admit I'm so content in my real life right now that I'm sort of, I don't know, just extremely happy. So
wonderful. That's
getting
great.
Getting back into bleak theory isn't my aim right now.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. We'll stop it here. And this has been a very enlightening dive into philosophy and psychology.
Okay. Thanks very much.